Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Prager, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, today, a little later in the show, we will be talking about the Democrats' new quote-unquote brand, if you will, the Better Deal situation. We're also going to be joined by John Pfeffer to discuss some things in the international sphere. But before we can move on, Missouri Senator Democrat Claire McCaskill has sent a letter to the Department of Defense seeking some clarification about how the Pentagon is spending its money. Her letter follows up on a report from last month from the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction that detailed how the Pentagon may have spent millions of dollars on uniforms that were, well, not the right uniforms. It appears the Pentagon spent $93 million to purchase 1.3 million uniforms and 88,000 extra pairs of pants with a forest pattern without conducting any formal testing to determine the pattern's effectiveness for use in Afghanistan. Now, it turns out, I did a little research here, only 2% of Afghanistan is covered by any forest at all. The report goes on to note that these uniforms will be more clearly visible targets to the enemy, and it also went on to say that it cost way too much because they had some outside firm who designed the forest pattern when, in fact, the Pentagon already had dozens of pattern designs available and on file for free. And honestly, it's a bit of an amusing story, but it's actually just the tip of the iceberg of a much more serious issue. This Special Inspector General John Sopko has been revealing all sorts of absurd waste of money coming from the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, like the $486 million used for cargo planes. Those were used cargo planes at that, that were then later just turned into scrap, or the $36 million command and control facility that was never used, or the $35 million spent on one gas station, and the $150 million spent on private villas and luxury meals for 5 to 10 employees of some sort of development task force. There were also the burn pits where 410 tons of functional equipment was just being burned, and they were burning this stuff on a daily basis, and it's so bad, hundreds of veterans are now suing, laying out that they were actually seriously harmed by inhaling the smoke and the fumes from these pits, an action that Sopko stated was quote-unquote indefensible. And it isn't just Afghanistan either. The Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction concluded in his final report that almost all of the $60 billion in reconstruction funds was simply just squandered. Things like $40 million to build a prison was never actually built. And there was one contractor that, quote, overcharged the U.S. government thousands of dollars for supplies, including $900 for a control switch valued at $7.05 and $80 for a piece of pipe that was valued at $1.41. And as CBS News lays out, U.S. officials actually decided to try to rebuild a pipeline under the Tigris River at a cost of $75 million. A geological study predicted the project might fail, and it did. Ironically enough, the report notes that one huge problem was the Americans never really consulted anyone who was an Iraqi on any of these large projects and actually had no idea a lot of the times if the projects were even necessary or wanted at all, which makes it not terribly surprising to also read in this report a case of, quote, a widespread ring of fraud led by former U.S. Army officers resulted in tens of millions of dollars in kickbacks and the criminal conviction of 22 people connected to government contracts. End quote. Clearly, there was a feedback loop of corruption where the veneer of reconstruction was being used just to create projects people could steal money from, which of course echoes the ongoing, yes, it's still happening in many different spheres, Fat Leonard scandal. You have to look this up if you haven't heard of it. It's reached the highest levels of the Navy. This guy, Fat Leonard, in exchange for cash, hotel rooms, prostitutes, alcohol, gambling, even some trip to Japanese Disney, I believe, for one of the children of an admiral, was then getting tens of millions of dollars in contracts to service the U.S. Navy in Singapore and various other Asian ports. And this conspiracy involved a number of top admirals. It even corrupted NCIS investigators who were helping them to cover up the crime. So the people investigating it also covering it up. Has to be one of the most open secrets out there, though, quite frankly, that the Pentagon is really just one giant pig trough for every military contractor and lobbyist connected to contractors to feed from. There's zero oversight and, quite frankly, very little appetite for it in Congress. So, no surprise when it turns out people are bilking the Department of Defense left and right. The Citizens United ruling has unleashed campaign finance cash in a way that harkened back to the old days, the old sack of cash under the table type of corruption. It used to be in the modern campaign finance era, you had to have a pretty broad network of very rich people if you were going to mount a viable campaign for the presidency. Now, Citizens United has more or less ended that, and one super rich billionaire can essentially take a candidate from zero to 60 all on their own. In 2012, we saw that with how Sheldon Adelson kept Newt Gingrich campaign alive, and that guy Foster Freeze, another real rich guy, did the same thing for Rick Santorum. This year, we saw the same thing, the way Trump was embraced by the Mercers, and of course, we've also seen how the Koch brothers have created this network of billionaires promoting candidates and agendas in ways that couldn't be before. And I say all that as a lead-in because the new White House communications director, Anthony Scaramucci, is actually a pretty good example of this. As The Intercept notes, quote, he was the national finance co-chair for Scott Walker's 2016 presidential campaign, raised money for Jeb Bush, and then personally maxed out to Trump's campaign and gave $100,000 to Rebuilding America Now, a pro-Trump super PAC. And just for the record, his hedge fund Skybridge Capital also gave $75,000 to Mitt Romney super PAC in 2012 and $100,000 to Karl Rove's super PAC in 2013. And along these lines, Scaramucci hosted a dinner in 2011, about 20-ish people, a lot of super rich financiers. He made some interesting statements. A reporter from The New Yorker was there. He made some interesting statements about the effect of Citizens United in a conversation with said reporter, saying that those at the dinner had witnessed, and this is a quote now, the activation of a sleeper cell of hedge fund managers against Obama. And here's another quote from Scaramucci. That's what you see happening in the hedge fund community because they now have the power because of Citizens United to aggregate capital into political action committees and influence the debate. The president has a philosophy of disdain towards wealth creation. That's just obvious, okay? We've talked about it all night. That was President Obama. So Scaramucci, a sleeper cell of hedge fund managers, is what was released by Citizens United. Now, you might think, okay, what politicians would they have in here? Has to be like some Republican. Nope. Al Gore and former L.A. mayor, now California gubernatorial candidate, and so-called progressive Anthony Villarosa, who apparently was so excited by one of these rich hedge fund guys who had a lot of ideas that he gave him his personal phone number. Looks like influence flows to both parties from the Wall Street honeypot. So the theme with President Trump's appointments to various regulatory agencies so far has been pretty clear. They all appear to come from the corporations that agency was previously regulating or somewhere in the ballpark, and they oppose pretty much all the regulating those different agencies have done in the past 8 or so years. If there was anywhere that you might hope that wasn't the case, it would probably be the EPA's Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, given that their mission is to protect you, your family, and the environment from potential risks from pesticides and toxic chemicals. Well, I'm here today to tell you that, sadly, it is in fact the case that the new appointee to head that office appears to be yet another fox guarding a henhouse. Michael Dorson, the new head of this office, has quite a record. In the early 2000s, DuPont, a chemical company, hired him to solve a problem. The company was using a chemical known as PFOA that was quite toxic to make Teflon and other products. So they had to work with the government in West Virginia to try to set some sort of standard for how much of this chemical in water was too toxic for people to drink. In other words, how much polluting of people's water could DuPont do before they were legally liable? Now, Dorson helped them come up with a number, 150 parts per billion, that became the standard in West Virginia from 2002 to 2006. Here's the problem, though. DuPont's own scientist in 1988, DuPont's own scientist, stated that the maximum safe level was actually 1 part per billion. Yes, Dorson helped trick West Virginia state officials into establishing a limit that was 150 times more than what DuPont's own scientist said was safe. Now, in May of 2016, the EPA set its limit for PFOA toxicity at 0.7 parts per billion. So you may also not be that surprised to know that in 2015, DuPont actually had to pay someone $1.6 million because they got kidney cancer from water that was poisoned by this PFOA coming from a DuPont plant. Now, all of this history is extraordinarily concerning, given that, as detailed by The Intercept and other folks, Doerson will directly control, quote, which chemicals are subject to the high priority reviews laid out in the new law, how many company requested risk evaluations the EPA will grant, and how the EPA will use its newly expanded authority to test chemicals. Oh, and just for the record here, one of the biggest supporters of Mr. Doerson when he was being promoted here, the EPA even released a press release about it, was a guy named Samuel Cohen, who said Doerson was, quote, well suited for the position of assistant administrator for the EPA. Well, who's Samuel Cohen? Turns out he was a fellow witness for DuPont in the trial where the chemical giant was found liable for causing kidney cancer. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we slightly shift gears by John Fether, who is an author and a very acclaimed playwright here in the D.C. area now, I must say, and also the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So not that long before you got here, an issue that we talked about the last time you were on the show became a bigger issue. That was the North Korea situation. There is now reports that are coming out. The LA Times is reporting it. Duck and Cover 2.0 is their headline. Washington Post reporting it that the government of the United States believes that, one, there are some ICBMs that from North Korea that could hit America. Okay, that people were saying that in the last test, maybe potentially whatever. But then two, obviously very relevant here, that there's significant technological progress, which seems to be a little bit more what these articles are concerned about. So the issue coming forward, you know, we'll see what it's going to be. But the Trump administration has also now restricted travel to North Korea. So this issue continuing to push forward here pretty rapidly, and even though it's not huge in the news, a big flashpoint.
Certainly is. I mean, it's been a controversy for many months over whether North Korea has the technical capability of striking the United States with an ICBM. It had a test. It mostly went up. It didn't go out. It came back down. So if you aggregate all that distance, yeah, maybe it could reach the United States. Whether it could actually target effectively the United States with an ICBM is another question. Whether they could put a nuclear warhead on the ICBM, another question still. But I think the major issue here is that, you know, North Korea is doing whatever it can to get the U.S. attention. And it knows that whenever there's a transition period, that the United States focuses on other issues. The Trump administration obviously focusing on domestic issues. It has one foreign policy priority that it has articulated, and that is destroying the Islamic State. North Korea, ignored. How does it get the U.S. attention? The only way that it's successfully gotten it in the past is by upping the ante. So they up the ante. The response from the Trump administration, well, it's confused. I mean, on the one hand, the Trump administration has said, we don't like strategic patience, which was the policy of the Obama administration. So we're going to do something new. Well, it held a strategic review of North Korea policy. And the conclusion was, maximum pressure plus engagement. Well, they've been trying more or less maximum pressure. In other words, they've upped the sanctions against North Korea or attempted to. As you said, the State Department has announced that it will suspend the travel or attempt to suspend travel for American tourists going to North Korea. We have done some shows of military resolve by sending aircraft carriers out there. But there hasn't been any engagement, no significant engagement. So what does that leave us with? Well, what it leaves us with is basically the Obama administration policy at this point of strategic patience. So I think the Trump administration is at sea. It's red line, so-called, that Trump had put out by Twitter that it would stop North Korea from launching an ICBM. Well, that red line apparently has passed without any repercussions. So there are a number of voices here in the United States that have said, look, I mean, we don't have a choice. Like it or not, we have to sit down and talk with North Korea, But so far, the Trump administration has yet to respond.
No, I mean, it really seems like, and this is the thing that's rarely reported, I feel like, and well, I actually feel like there's zero analysis of this issue in the U.S. media, and I'm not just saying the mainstream media, I think by and large, but it just seems like the DPRK kind of has it over a barrel to some degree, because not only is there no option where many people, non-diplomatic option where many people do not die in South Korea and Japan, but on top of that, and this is an underreported story, although the Financial Times had a great article about this, the economy in North Korea has been improving because they've been able to divert more resources away from the standing army because of the nuclear weapons. South Korea has now jacked up the money they're paying to defectors by 6 times, which is a sign they can't get people to come out. So it seems like kind of on all angles here, the way the North Koreans have played this has been relatively savvy, and that ultimately there is only one option, which is direct negotiations, I think, between the U.S. and Korea. Now, I mean, it seems to me, and tell me if you disagree, that the six-party talks to me seems, I don't know, a little anachronistic now because Japan, South Korea, and America aren't even on the same page.
North Korea has demanded all along bilateral negotiations, one-on-one with the United States. It believes, and rightly so, that the United States holds basically all the military cards in East Asia, so why talk to anybody else? However, at least for diplomatic niceties, it can be useful to have other folks at the table, in part because other parties have different leverage points with North Korea. China, obviously, with trade, Russia, to a certain extent, with trade, South Korea, because it has in the past had both political and economic contacts, Japan, because it potentially could play an important economic role in any kind of deal that goes forward. But whatever multilateral arrangement you set up, ultimately it's going to have to include some bilateral discussions between the United States and North Korea. You're right to a certain extent that North Korea has played us well, but we have to recognize North Korea still has a lousy hand. It plays it very well, but its hand is not good. It's extremely vulnerable to weather conditions for its agriculture, extremely vulnerable to inputs, whether it's energy or natural resources of other types, or it's an industry. And it, you know, these tests are very expensive, these missile tests. And yes, it can divert some of the money from its standing army, which it uses as a surplus labor force anyway, but it doesn't have a lot of money, you know, and the sanctions do have some effect on the amount of capital that goes into the country. So that doesn't detract from the urgency for either side, the United States or North Korea, to have these discussions. It's just a question of, frankly, when will Washington make the decision that it has made at every point in every last administration to sit down and talk with the North Korean?
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see that, although given the number of unfilled positions at the State Department, I don't know who's going to suggest it to anyone. Shocking, honestly. I mean, I'm not, you know, whatever, I'm critical of 90% of what they do, but it just seems like, how do you run an actual department with no undersecretaries who know any? I think there's not even an undersecretary for policy. But let's put a pin in that for the current moment here. I want to come back to that. I want to come back to a little bit more. I want to talk a little bit about sanctions as well. New potential sanctions on Russia, new potential sanctions on Iran, which I think are very heavily tied into what we've seen happen in Korea. And who knows how that's going to play out, could be very significant. So we are going to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And we are continuing to be joined here on the show by John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, also an author and a playwright. And we left off talking a little bit about the Northeast Asia situation, I guess, if you could. And there's been some issue, U.S. sort of being barred, sanctions and the like. We're seeing similar pushes now on Iran and on Russia. And new Iran sanctions, very controversial, or maybe they all are, but maybe more controversial because Iran is alleging that the U.S. is violating the nuclear deal and that pushing forward on these sanctions would just continue that. And it's sort of a role reversal on what, you know, was the everyone said at the time in Congress who was opposed, oh, Iran's just going to violate the deal. It appears maybe the U.S. going in the same way. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, Iran's allegations are frankly persuasive. Donald Trump, both in his rhetoric and his actions, have basically been discouraging other countries from investing in Iran. And part of the nuclear deal, of course, is for Iran to mothball its program and to be then welcomed back into the economic community. A reduction of sanctions related to nuclear actions, and then also, facilitation for investment to go in there. Now, there are lots of businesses that are eager to get in there. I mean, obviously, French energy companies, Boeing, strike a deal to sell a huge number of airplanes to Iran. So there's an enormous economic interest here. And ordinarily, one would expect Trump, the deal maker, to perceive this as a plus. I mean, here, the United States has an advantage, perhaps, going in. It can compete very successfully to get these contracts. And yet, he is, I think, burdened by not only what he said during the campaign, but the perspectives of his advisors, some of his advisors, the more reactionary advisors, which is to tear up the Iran deal. And to tear it up, well, as astutely as possible. In other words, to shift the blame onto Iran itself. These additional sanctions are perceived, at least by Iran, as, well, what you want us to do is to get pissed off that you're throwing more sanctions at us so that we ultimately will violate the deal so that you can say the deal is off. And so this is the congressional strategy, I think, that the Trump administration supports. On the other hand, as we saw from the certification that Iran actually abides by the deal, which the administration has to do every 90 days, during that meeting, according to the New York Times, Trump desperately didn't want to certify, but there were people in the administration, probably Tillerson, probably McMaster, maybe Mattis, who said, that's not a good idea. So at the moment, he is being restrained by some folks. The question is, 90 days from now, will they still be able to do that? Or even in the case of Tillerson, will he even still be there?
Right. Which is interesting because he was the sort of person mooted to be the adult in the room and the whole thing. So he's been this big international businessman. He knows all these world leaders. I don't know, but it hasn't been good reports out of the State Department from people who work there. Very controversial situation there. So yes, that'll be very interesting, I think, to see how that one plays out. I mean, it does seem... I mean, the whole thing, it's just remarkable how little institutional support the Iran deal seems to have. I mean, I would have thought that something pushed through by a very popular president would have way more support. But it appears that the influence of the Israeli government has convinced basically the entire U.S. foreign policy apparatus, the ones who didn't already agree, of course, which was probably a good decision, position of them anyway, that somehow this deal is terrible. But it's difficult for me to see how this deal has destabilized the Middle East when it seems like it's the U.S. allies that are doing more than Iran. Say what you want to say about Hezbollah, but certainly Lebanon is no Raqqa or whatever.
And it's not just Israel. I mean, it's also Saudi Arabia and, the kind of what we might call the radical Sunni powers in the region, who ordinarily might not, link up with Israel, but on this issue, they see eye to eye. And the worst thing that the Trump administration can do, and frankly is doing, is intervening into this intra-Islamic debate between largely Shia world and the largely Sunni world. I mean, it doesn't just break down religiously, confessionally, but there are political issues involved here and economic issues, but the Trump administration is blundering into this without really understanding it. I mean, it's just saying, well, Saudi Arabia is our ally and Israel is our ally and Iran obviously isn't our ally, even though, and this is the crazy part, the American business community, which frankly was largely responsible for making sure the detente with China went through because they said, aha, 1 billion people, that's an incredible market. Iran, comparably, it's not the same size, but
sure,
extraordinarily wealthy country, a huge middle class, great market, lots of stuff to buy. The American business community is salivating. And this should be the one issue that Trump should recognize pragmatically is a win-win. Mm-hmm. And yet, precisely because of this constellation of geopolitical influences, Saudi Arabia, Israel, it's basically working against U.S. interests on this issue.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. They tell me that some of the hottest restaurants in Tehran are these like U.S. burger places. That's like a big craze over the past like year or so. And there's all these Iranians who've lived in America setting up these like Five Guys style places. And it's just like you'd think at a certain point, I don't know. If it was logical, we wouldn't be sitting here talking. You know, similar issue in terms of the business community with increased Russia sanctions. I mean, this is I think a much bigger turnaround than it actually gets credit for. I mean, I'm sure you remember this quite well. Right before Obama put in the first new round of anti-Russia sanctions, Business Roundtable, U.S. Chamber of Commerce take out full-page ads in the New York Times Post and Wall Street Journal opposing them. They sort of strong-armed them, cajoled them into it. And now, again, it seems like sort of the politicians are kind of far ahead of even significant other parts of the elites here and the way this is playing out. Trump saying he will sign the Russia sanctions bill if it comes before him. I don't know if we can trust him. We'll see. Maybe he will. Maybe he won't. Seems like it'd be very difficult for him not to at this stage in the game. But it just – almost like a separate foreign policy and so on, a couple of these issues being run out of the capital.
Well, you know, in the same sense that the Iran issue is subject to an intra-Islamic debate, I would argue that the Russia issue is subject to an intra-Republican debate within the Republican Party. You know, there are lots of people in the Republican Party that are uncomfortable with Trump and what he represents. And, you know, the Russia issue is definitely something they want to create space. They don't want to be taken down by any scandal. They don't want to be taken down by association with a foreign policy they disagree with. Russia is a relatively easy issue to sell to their constituents back home. There's not going to be a lot of people who stick up for Russia. So I think this is the wedge issue that's emerging, at least on foreign policy issues. Obviously, there's healthcare, there's pipeline issues. There are lots of domestic issues. But on the foreign policy side, this is where the Republicans are trying to create some daylight so that whatever happens with the administration over the next 12 months, that when the midterm elections come up, they don't have mud on their face.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense from their perspective moving forward. Unfortunate to see major policy being driven by these kind of domestic concerns, but when has it ever not been, I guess, is the other piece of that question. So it's going to be interesting, I think, to see how it plays out. I mean, it does seem sort of that it raises another question. This is a much older question, of course, but one relevant to folks who are around during the heat of the Iraq War is sanctions as a weapon of war. I mean, that's something that's rarely ever talked about. I mean, I think most people see sanctions as the, like, humane alternative, but we know, you know, 500,000 kids in Iraq died for it. I mean, whatever. I don't want to go through the whole thing. It's obviously a huge deal that in some ways this sort of increased use of sanctions, I think in the Obama administration, I think in this administration, really is sort of war by another means on a lot of these countries.
Absolutely. And it speaks to the poverty of our non-military diplomatic tools. Mm. And in fact, you know, often in the discussions, people will say, well, we can't, you know, war is off the table, pragmatically speaking, because, you know, it's not going to advance U.S. interests or it's going to cost too much toll in death and injury, et cetera, et cetera. And then what do we have left? Well, sanctions. That's it. You know, that's the only kind of punitive idea that they can come up with. Now, sanctions, of course, are varied, you know, so you can be a little bit more, quote unquote, surgical in your application of them. But I think the most important question that distinguishes sanctions from one another is the kind of country they're assessed against. Mm. So if you're talking about a country that's already on the verge of failure, you know, you apply sanctions to that country, you are going to see enormous human cost. If you're talking about sanctions against a relatively industrialized country, there will be suffering. There's no question about it. But we're talking more about, you know, people having to have difficulty, you know, going out to eat, maybe, or you might see some of the poor sections of the population rely more on government support. You don't see the catastrophic kind of effect you saw in Iraq during those sanctions. So I think I would distinguish between the impact of sanctions that way.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very relevant point here. You know, one other sort of sanctions related issue is certainly what's going to take place here in sort of the, I don't even know how I want to call this, sort of the condominium of issues around both sort of the Qatar UAE controversy and then also the issue of Yemen. I think the two things are somewhat related there and how that's going to play out. And it seems that we're sort of working on two tracks. In Congress, there seems to be more of a desire to do something about Yemen. I don't think the White House seems to care at all. And on the White House, it seems that there now is some frustration with the Qatar UAE crisis. They leaked that thing to the Post. Obviously, it was clearly from the White House about how UAE was behind the fake information. And it's sort of interesting to see that now it looks like these contradictions between the various U.S. client states in that area starting to play out contradictorily for the White House in a way that's going to be difficult to manage.
Absolutely. You know, from the Trump administration's perspective, the last thing they want is some kind of conflict within the GCC. Okay, you know, it's the Gulf Cooperation Council. It's fine to have an intra-Islamic conflict if it's Iran versus Saudi Arabia. But if we're talking about these Gulf states, they're supposed to act together from the administration's point of view. Okay, you know, they might single out an extraordinarily poor country like Yemen, a near failed state, but at least they'd have a unified policy against Yemen. On everything else, they should be working together from the administration's point of view. So when I talk about the Trump administration, you know, basically stumbling backward into this conflict, this is a subtlety that is lost on them. Now, of course, Tillerson, given his background, given the fact that he knew many of the actors in the Gulf states, he gets it, obviously. These are his friends. He doesn't like to see his friends falling out.
Right.
And he is uniquely suited to perhaps work with the other countries, Kuwait and France being the two main ones that are playing a mediating role. But I don't think the administration has enough unity or, as you point out, enough staff to play any significant role in resolving this information, resolving this conflict. And as regard to Yemen, you know, Congress would like to sever many forces in Congress. Democrats plus some Republicans would like to cut off this support for the Saudis in Yemen, because it's such an embarrassment, because it implicates the United States in war crimes, and they just want distance from it. The administration, because Saudi Arabia is, you know, best friends forever, they're reluctant to do that.
Yeah, no, it's just sort of interesting in thinking about sort of the role. This is maybe more the novelistic sort of aspect of the White House or whatever, but everyone comparing Trump to Nixon from the point of view of impeachment. But I would say the way he uses his Secretary of State, very similar to William Rogers, a person who is clearly qualified for the job, had some relationship and trust with the president, but also appears to be there only for that reason, to be more of like a figurehead, obviously seems to be somewhat out of the loop of mainstream decision making there. I mean, extraordinary for me to send someone like Jared Kushner as your shuttle diplomacy guy in the Middle East makes no sense. I mean, how are you evaluating Tillerson's role? So, I mean, it just seems like he's not really doing that much.
Well, you know, the comparison you make is a telling one, because at that point, Rogers was sidelined. But he wasn't just sidelined by Nixon, he was sidelined by Kissinger. And Kissinger, as much as we might dislike him and everything that he's done, he was a smart guy. He had an idea of what to do. And he marshaled all sorts of resources to do that, whether it was detente with the Soviet Union or detente with China, or a variety of other things that he did. We don't have that in Tillerson. We don't have that in McMaster. We don't have that, obviously, in Jared Kushner. Mm. We don't have a figure who pairs with a Trump, you know, who also knows nothing about foreign policy, to exercise some grand plan. Basically, what you have are fiefdoms presided over by, in some cases, only one feudal lord who doesn't even have too many minions with him. And they're fighting it out for the control of U.S. foreign policy, or in some sense, dividing up what had once been a coherent, more or less, policy under Obama and basically transforming it into an incoherent set of policies. Tillerson, you know, as we said, he's frustrated with the position. It's unclear how long he's going to hang out there just to kind of serve as a quote-unquote moderating influence on the Kushners and the Bannons and the Trumps. It's hard to imagine who could be persuaded to take that position given the treatment that Tillerson has been subjected to. They might find another kind of patsy, shall we say, that they can put into that position. But, you know, Tillerson is useful for Trump because of his contacts, because of his business experience, because especially energy issues. Who else could they turn to?
Right. Good point. A couple minutes here before we close, I want to get to one other issue. And since we are live on 105.5 FM here in the D.C. area, you, sir, have a new play, Paper, I believe. It's at the Fringe Festival here. Tell us a little bit about the play and where folks can see it.
Sure. So we just extended. We have two more dates, this Friday at 5 p.m., this Sunday at 3:45, and the extension week for Fringe. Paper is a story of a conflict between a student and a professor. And the conflict is all about race, all about class, all about gender, all about age. Every conceivable kind of mode of conflict takes place as a result of misunderstandings at the level of language and at the level of personality. You see the first, the conflict from the first act from his point of view, see the conflict in the second act from her point of view, and then a surprise for the third act. When you think, well, what other angle could we possibly have on this? That's when we kind of take the rug out from under you.
Right on. And so people can see that here Friday and Sunday, last two dates at the Fringe Festival, which is out on New York Avenue.
Yeah, so the Fringe has a headquarters on Florida Avenue. It's the Trinidad Theater. I think it's 1358 Florida Avenue Northeast. So it's near the corner of H and 14th Street.
Okay, so that's a very accessible location for those who want to see, and I think it sounds quite good. I know that it's gotten very good reviews, hence why you got a little extended here. So certainly, I hope everyone goes to see Paper. That is the name. Paper is this play. You can check it out. It is at the Capitol Fringe Festival here Friday at what time?
Friday at 5 p.m. and Sunday at 3:45.
Excellent. 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 Well, thank you so much. That was John Pfeffer. In addition to being a playwright, he's the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. That is going to do it for our time here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik on 105.5 FM here in Washington, D.C., as well as around the world. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the implications flowing from the Democrats' alleged new platform, brand, slogan, whatever you want to call it here. And we are very happy to be joined by Dr. Richard Wolff, who's an economist and a professor at the New School University in New York City, and also the host of Economic Update, which is both a radio and television program. Dr. Wolff, thank you so much for joining us on the show here today.
Glad to be here and speaking with you.
So I wanted to start here with this new Democratic Party program, the so-called Better Deal. I mean, certainly the name didn't do much for me there, lacking a little creativity. What are your thoughts in general on this effort at the Democrats to rebrand and the substance of their new, quote-unquote, economically focused platform?
Well, I guess my first reaction was that this will go down in history as a wonderful example of everything under the heading too little, too late. It strikes me as obvious to those of us who have been even a little bit active over the last 5 years that an enormous part of this country, the kind of people who might very well support a Democratic Party that had anything like its complexion under the Franklin Roosevelt period, that those people have felt more and more alienated from, unrepresented by, ignored by, disrespected by, I could go on, the Democratic Party, and that the loss of these people's votes, the loss of even more these people's enthusiasm, action, activism, was hobbling the Democratic Party. That seemed clear to many of us. Now Mr. Schumer and some of the others seem to have finally figured it out after unspeakable losses piled upon losses. Again, it's for me too little and too late.
I think that a lot of people feel that way. I think a lot of people also felt that it had just sort of, I don't even know what the right word is here, but maybe sort of a little bit of a consultant vibe to it in the fact that the way that it was branded. I mean, it seemed like for a lot of people it was maybe backward looking in terms of using the slogan. I mean, I think some people have a good idea of what the New Deal is, but the younger you get, probably the less and less you have real connection to it. And certainly the Square Deal, Fair Deal, who even knows, sort of harkens back to a previous era. So, I mean, I'm somewhat curious about what you thought about that. I mean, it seems that to some degree, the Democrats' approach is, I mean, it's not that it's irrelevant to what's going on today, but it almost seems like it's pitched towards an idea of an economy that's structured very much like it's in the 1950s, as opposed to being rooted in the here and now.
Yeah, I think that's what I mean by it's too little and too late. It might have been a clever slogan. It might have been something effective a long time ago. But now it looks, tastes, feels, and smells like something cooked up in Madison Avenue, a cheap and easy way, they hope, the Democratic Party leaders, to win back the people that they have alienated. But you've alienated those people over decades. And you are not going to win them back by a cheap slogan. You're going to have to do all kinds of things they have not done yet. You're going to have to be active in ways that that party hasn't done for so long that it's hard even to remember the last time. So my guess is that, yeah, this is that minimal effort to try to win some of the Bernie Sanders folks to look again at the Democratic Party, even if they're holding their nose, because they can tell themselves that, oh, look at that statement. They are sensitive to working class people and their needs again, but you'll have to do much more to win over a significant number of those people than this.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I think is interesting and relevant to what you're saying in terms of too little, too late is, you know, they made a big deal out of the $15 an hour minimum wage plank, which, you know, hey, I'm for it wherever we can get it. But I think as many people have pointed out in many of the places where it's actually been passed, that's still not a living wage. And it just seemed like Democrats were throwing out some prescriptions and different pieces there, but without having a real conversation about sort of the cost of living, the state of working class people in America. It's like, you know, it's one thing to sort of address the issues that are concerning me in general, but you know, you think about the people who don't vote, for instance, who are probably the people who think, well, hey, sure, 15 is great, but where I live, I really need 18 or whatever it may be to have a living wage. This doesn't really seem like the thing that political movements are born of. I'll say that much.
Yeah, there's no enthusiasm here at all. Let's remember that Mrs. Clinton couldn't even be brought to 15. She was talking at one point, I think Obama said 10 and she said 12, and I mean, it's such an absurd conversation. I'm a professional economist. For 40 years, this country has widened the gap between rich and poor people. That's the problem. That's what alienates so many people. That's what angers so many people. That's what's in many ways hobbling our economy. Either you're going to deal with doing something really significant about reversing that inequality, or you're not. The Democratic Party is clearly committed to not, because raising the minimum wage to $10, to $12, to $15, that's not going to do this job. That's not going to reverse these inequalities. It's marginally good, and of course everybody supports it, because at $7.25 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage in the United States, we have the odd distinction of having one of the lowest minimum wages in the advanced industrial world. The minimum wage in Australia is more than twice that, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a pathetic display of the Democratic Party hoping that by a few Madison Avenue phrases, they're going to attract people who have been living through an inequality festival in this country in ways that are now making them angry. And again, what the Democratic Party did this last few days with these statements, it's almost provocative because it's so little and it's so late.
That's a very good point. It does kind of have that feel to it. You know, one issue that popped into this that I didn't really expect to see, but I was sort of thought is a very relevant issue of conversation, was this issue of monopoly power, growing corporate monopolies. Allegedly, they're going to introduce some legislation to try to limit that. I mean, you know, whatever. That is what it is. But on a more broader sense, it does seem like that is an important issue for at least progressive-minded people to really sort of reclaim and push back on in a lot of ways. I mean, I think the Obama administration was not very active from my concern, from my point of view, in terms of quote-unquote antitrust action. And it does seem like that is a big sort of issue, the issue of concentrated corporate power, that's a nut that sort of has to be cracked for there to be anything sort of looking like a more transformative economic policy to emerge.
Yeah, and I think there again, the Democratic Party is notable for having little to say and doing even less than that. I mean, let's give a few examples. The economic crisis that swept Obama into power, the one that hit in 2007 and 8, had as one of the mantras of what the Obama administration said that the banks had to be supported because they were, quote, too big to fail, our major banks. And out of that came a fairly widely understood notion that that wasn't good, that the government should not be blackmailed by banks who demand to have everything done to help them through a crisis because they threatened that if you didn't do that, they would fail and take the whole economy down with them. So how amazing it is that as the Obama administration continues, it does absolutely nothing to reduce the size of these big banks. Quite the contrary. The Obama administration helped to bring entities together. Failed banks were absorbed by those that were a little less in trouble. And you ended up with the biggest banks of 2007 and 8 bigger today than they were then. The Democrats didn't do anything. Let me give a second example. We have been talking endlessly for the last two or three years about medical insurance. The bill that we call Obamacare, now the effort of the Republicans and Trump to undo it. The problem in our medical care system is really twofold. Number one, we don't insure everybody, which for a modern rich country is a medical, ethical, moral outrage. But I don't want to focus on that. I want to focus on the other problem, which is that Americans spend more for their medical care than any other people in the advanced industrial world. We spend about 17 to 18% of our total GDP, our total economy's output, for medical things. And I mean here four industries: doctors, hospitals, the producers of drugs and medical equipment, and finally, the medical insurance companies. These four industries operate what ought to be called a medical industrial complex, a monopoly. They get together and they basically say to the rest of us in America, we are going to charge you more than is paid by any people anywhere for medical care. And we can do it because where are you going to go? We're the doctors, we're the hospitals, we're the drug and device makers, and we're the insurers. You want to deal with your medical problems, you have to buy from the four of us who together operate this monopoly. Let me underscore, this is a monopoly problem. It's a problem for Obamacare, which is why even though it extended coverage to more people, it ended up making us all pay more for medical care. Why? Because Obama didn't dare touch the monopoly. And of course, the GOP and Trump, even less so. So we are all stuck with paying too much. And for those of you that have been bamboozled, perhaps, who might be listening and thinking, well, we pay more than everybody else, but our medical care is better, I'm afraid that's not the case. Other countries who pay much, much less live longer than Americans do, visit hospitals less than Americans do, get cared for by a doctor less often than other people do, have fewer, you get the picture. We have a mediocre outcome, but we pay more than everybody else. If there weren't a monopoly, that situation would have been changed. And the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have done absolutely nothing to stop this process.
Well, I mean, it sort of leads into my next question, which is, You know, I think historically sort of great social movements, which it seems to me a sort of radical overturn here of the way the economy works can fit into that mold, usually are sort of brought at least into the mainstream, if not, you know, into some at least limited form of power through third party movements. I mean, the Republican Party, certainly the Populist Party, maybe the Progressive Party. You could maybe argue the Bull Moose Party. That's a sort of separate issue. But I say all that just to say, you know, can people even really believe or trust that the Democrats can be a vessel for these general type of changes? I mean, I think people are saying, like, yes, we want to see, you know, more and more aggressive pushes on, you know, a lot of these different issues. But it just seems that sort of the upshot of a lot of what we're saying here is not only have the Democrats not done enough up to this point, but perhaps it's not like just a mistake, if you will.
No, I'm sure it's not a mistake. You know, you can see very clearly that the same big businesses in America that have traditionally supported the Republicans for all the reasons most people know, but that those big companies have long ago figured out that the smart move is to give lots of money to the Democratic Party. You make both parties dependent for the big bucks you need in a television era to run campaigns, make them both dependent on the same social forces, big business, and you'll get the kind of gentlemanly agreement not to shake the barrel that I just described in terms of medical, the four medical industries. So I don't expect much from the Democratic Party. But, you know, I can't foresee the future any better than anyone else. Is it conceivable that the Democratic Party might so change that we would all be surprised? Well, I think, you know, it could do a hell of a lot better than it's doing now. We know that from the 1930s, which, by the way, was the last time that the American capitalist system crashed. The one in 2008 is generally understood to be the second worst, overtaken only by the Great Depression of the 1930s. So we are in a bad situation. We remain in it. We've been in it for 10 years now, pretty much. So is it possible that the Democratic Party could be so shaken by its defections, by its losses, and by the demands of the people it needs to have vote for it? Yes, but my guess would be that the best way to do that would be precisely to threaten it with other political parties emerging to its left that are able and willing to say and advocate what the Democratic Party isn't. I mean, basically, Mr. Schumer's statement of the other day is an attempt to snatch away what Bernie Sanders was saying, or at least part of it. And there you see again that an outsider, Bernie, I understand he's in the Democratic Party, but relative to the people who run that party, he was an outsider. That's why he was treated the way he was. And yet here they are basically copying at least a little in the hope that that's enough to undercut what he represented. I don't think it will be. So my guess is that for a good long time, it will be outside of the Democratic Party that the things have to happen, like Occupy Wall Street, like, in a way, the real support for Bernie, which came from people who had little interest and little support for the Democratic Party, which is what frightens the leaders of that party as much as to even make them say these words.
Slightly shifting gears here, a question I wanted to raise to you that perhaps only an economist can answer, but I think is relevant and sort of small sleeper issue here in terms of how it's being reported, but a major issue in terms of how it could actually affect things. The Federal Reserve saying that they're going to pursue this tapering, unwinding a little bit, the quantitative easing. Obviously, they've pumped all this money into the system. Now, if they're trying to walk it back, it seems like it had big impacts on the way in, so perhaps it could on the way out. Your thoughts on the Fed's tapering proposal here that we've seen in the past, couple weeks, month or so?
Yeah, I think the important thing to recognize is that the Federal Reserve half the time doesn't know what it's doing. And I don't mean that as a terrible criticism. I mean that they're required to move up and down the interest rates and the quantity of money in circulation and so on based on their guesses. And that's all it is about how the economy is evolving and where it's going. To keep in perspective, let's remember that in the years leading up to the great crash of 2007 and 8, the Federal Reserve did not see it coming, did not take the actions necessary to prevent it, could not take the actions necessary to keep it the low-level economic downturn that that all of its primary folks declared it to be at the beginning. In other words, they have a long history of not getting it right, okay? Just to keep it in mind, there have been other times when they have done the things they're supposed to do, and it helped the situation. But there's no guarantee whatever. They thought they could pump money into the economy after 2008 that would get us a quick recovery and we'd be back to normal. Here we are with a lost decade for most Americans. They didn't solve the problem quickly. They didn't get the country back to normal. They have helped big banks and the stock market to recover because that's where all the money they pumped in went. But that's a long way from recovering an economy, which we are in. So what we've had is an economy on life support, an economy in real trouble since 2008, undergirded, supported by a historically unprecedented period of virtually zero interest rates, coupled with trillions of dollars of money pumped into the economy, and let's not forget it, the bailing out of the banks between 2007 and 2011 that also took trillions of dollars. To withdraw that now, which they feel they have to do because they're afraid of the consequences of all that extra money and all those low interest rates, that is to take somebody off life support. And the truth is, the American economy, like an injured person taken off life support, is taking an enormous risk. And that's why you see the hemming and hawing of Janet Yellen and other people from the Federal Reserve, because yes, they raise the interest rates, but here's some evidence that the life-supported person, in this case the economy, isn't going to make it, so they slow down, which they've done in the last few days again. Everyone should understand, capitalism is in a very bad place, the worst place it's been in for a long time, and the people in charge of managing it are flying by the seat of their pants, and nobody should have a confidence that it's any more than that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Richard Wolff, thank you so much for joining the show. If you want to hear more from him, which I know you do, you can check out his both radio and TV program, Economic Update. So please do and get more on all these issues and even more than that. That's going to do it for our time here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.